Hey guys, this is Pete from Red Flag. I'm sitting down with Megan Wildhood to talk about her poem Vapor and a couple of other great things. So, Megan, thanks for joining us via Skype from Seattle. How sure. are you?
Thanks for having me.
So, we usually ask people right from the get-go about their mail, and I'm gonna continue that trend by asking, what's the most unique piece of mail that you have received within your memory?
So I understand unique maybe to mean unusual, and so one time I received the keys to a Toyota in a mini manila envelope. They were bubble wrapped, came with a post-it note that said only, thanks a billion, and then the next line, Bunny, and it was unclear whether Bunny was the signature or the addressee. So this was probably like 9 years ago, and I have no explanation at all. I actually took them to the local police station because I wasn't sure what was going on with these keys, and they said, you know, if they learn anything, then they'll get back to me. But I never heard anything. So that's probably, it's very weird. And I periodically think about that and sort of wish that I knew whatever happened and how they got to me.
Well, but, were the keys addressed like to you, or was it just like addressed to your address?
It was just to my address. There was no name. And then there was also no return address either. But it was my address, and it was my apartment number.
Right.
So I don't know.
That's strange. That's really funny though. I don't know if you listened to the to any of the other ones interviews, but that's out of all the people that have said what they've received, that's an interesting one. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So, poetry though. So as far as writing poetry, I know your bio says that you are a saxophone player and a scuba diver, but where does poetry fit into saxophone and scuba diving?
Oh, gosh. So I think I've been writing poetry since before either of those things happened, but I actually started writing poetry to learn words, but then I didn't stop, and then I sort of felt like all I was doing was writing. But I was really interested in the sounds of language, and not necessarily rhymes, but just sort of how words can fit together just by their sound and by the music of language. We grew up with a baby grand piano in our house. It was inherited from my dad's mom. And my dad says that musical talent skips a generation in our family, so he could do nothing with it. But I really loved it. But you can't march with a piano, and I wanted to be in the marching band. So I picked saxophone, which was the only instrument that I could make a sound out of. And then I started thinking about how music was kind of its own language. And I don't try to write in sort of lyrical, musical language, but that's just sort of how it seems to happen for me. So they're related in that I've been doing them for kind of a while, and sometimes when I can't think of a way to end a poem or a title for a poem, I'll take out my saxophone and sort of play around with sound until something comes in relation to the poem.
Nice.
Yeah.
So your saxophone playing, is that tenor or alto or?
Yeah, it's actually all of them. I marched with an alto because tenor was too heavy, but I played tenor in jazz bands. I own an alto, so that was my main one, but I love the soprano. That's my favorite one.
Oh, okay.
Once you can play one of them, you can kind of play them all, but it's sort of the same fingering, but you have to have really powerful lungs to play the bigger ones. And I'm kind of a tiny little girl, so that tenor was probably as low as I could get.
Sure.
with that.
I started playing alto in sophomore year of high school.
Oh.
And then I switched to tenor. And then after high school, I only used a school saxophone, so I wasn't able to get one.
Yeah.
But I miss it. Yeah, I marched with a tenor. My best friend marched with a Barry.
I was so jealous of that. I love those.
Right, they're nice.
They're awesome.
So I mean, scuba diving. Tell me about that. How does that? Do you get inspired from scuba diving, or is that just purely or is that like a hobby? Do you go and like explore the water, I guess?
I write a lot about nature, which that sounds incredibly trite and banal, but I happen to love being out in nature. So I do take a lot of inspiration from that. I was on the swim team when I was in high school, and my mom says that I should have been born a fish. My dad wanted to get scuba dive certified back in 1985 with my mom, but then I was born. So he had never really lost that desire. And when I got old enough, back when I did it, you had to be 12. And now I think you only have to be 10. But in the 90s, you had to be 12. And so my dad asked if I wanted to take the class with him. And so because I loved the water, and I have always was slightly more comfortable on water than on land, actually. So I got certified with my dad as a junior diver, which is, yeah, when you're under 18, that's the certification that you get. And we took the class together. His best friend from college actually owned a dive shop in Colorado, where I'm from. And so we got to take the classes with him, and we got some private lessons. And then we had to obviously fly elsewhere for our open water certification because Colorado doesn't really have any water. So we did those in Mexico. And my family took 7 trips to Cozumel, which is an island off of the Yucatan Peninsula, just across from Cancun. And that's where we did our open water certification, where I've done the majority of my diving. And some of the things that I've seen down there have inspired some interesting images that I've been able to use in some poems. And I haven't been diving in quite a while, but my husband wants to try it out. So we're hoping that we can get back into it. It's a little easier on the coast, although Puget Sound is probably far too cold for me. But so it's a hobby. It's a fairly expensive hobby. But it's also sort of a sentimental thing because I got to do it with my dad. And I was the only one of my siblings that was interested at all. So.
Sure. Getting back to your poetry here.
Yeah.
Do you, aside from obviously nature and as well as musicality of language, which those are very much my aesthetics as well.
Oh, cool.
Do you have any poets or collections of poetry that, when you look back, have like influenced the way that you write or the way that you you read and things like that?
So I'm definitely, I feel like, I went to Walt Whitman Elementary School, and so he was the first poet that I ever heard of. So I started reading Leaves of Grass just so that I could figure out what my school was named after. And that, I think probably, I was very young, I was like 8 or 9, so I don't know that I really understood a lot of it. But I remember thinking like, gosh, I really want to do this. This is what I want to do. It kind of chose me also, though. I think that I'd probably be writing whether I wanted to or not. Currently, I actually find that I'm pretty shaped by the work or the approach to the work of writing of David Foster Wallace, who was not a poet, but primarily a fiction writer, whose nonfiction is just impossibly funny and terminally aware. He is famous for his book *Infinite Jest*, and which I'm slogging through right now. It's over 1,000 pages and has 400 pages of endnotes. but I like the, I don't agree with everything that he did, and most of it I'll be blessed if I'm able to do half as well ever. But one of the things that's inspiring about Wallace to me is that he sort of put all of his guts into everything that he wrote. Which, I mean, it's kind of crazy to do that. It's madness to put yourself out there. But that's, I like that. That's sort of what I find to be really inspiring and exciting. But sort of longer term wise, I've been lifted up again and again by Wendell Berry. He also not primarily a poet, but he is, his beautiful simplicity and insight, which I think in large part probably comes from his life as an Appalachian farmer, is, again, the tie into nature, has inspired me to write many, many poems. I have loved the work of Maya Angelou and Christian Wiman, particularly his collection Riven and Rita Dove. I really respect E.E. Cummings, even as I understand maybe 11% of what he wrote. Louise Gluck should probably also get a mention here, too. She's mostly great. It's the imagery, like the really strong natural imagery that's always very surprising in what it's used for in terms of the message to the reader.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Campbell, I don't know if you're familiar with Campbell McGrath, but Campbell McGrath has a collection called Shannon, which is an interpretation of George Shannon's experiences when he was lost. George Shannon was a member of the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Oh, yeah.
And for about 14 days, he was like, or no, 30, I don't know. There was some, I can't remember the number of days. He was lost. And so Campbell McGrath wrote a collection of poetry that's very kind of visual, but also of existential even, too.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting. And I recommend that book to a lot of people, or that collection to a lot of people, because it's really great.
I'll write it down. That sounds like it's definitely right up my alley there.
Yeah. So as far as this particular poem, Vapor, I mean, where did this come from? What brought this about? Is there a story behind it, or just, you know, hanging out one day looking at the clouds?
As is typical with a lot of the things that I write, a lot of the poems I write, I usually get one line or a thought or a phrase, or sometimes I even like mishear a song lyric. And then I'm like, I want to use that line. And so I kind of construct a poem sort of around that line or idea. So clouds are overdone in poetry generally, on either side of the metaphor. But I was walking home from work one day, and I have to walk across a bridge to get home from work, and I'm looking in the reflection of the water, and I see a really thick cloud right there in the middle of summer, and a person walking the other way, and it looked for a brief second like the reflection of the person got sort of swallowed up by the reflection of the cloud. And that was just a startling image to me. And so I think the idea of a person being swallowed up by a cloud sort of morphed into a person being like a cloud. And I think in part because clouds are, they seem really substantial to us down here. But they're pretty much made of almost nothing. And yet they can create all of this beauty and storms and catastrophes and all of this. And I think that's kind of similar to people, as is sort of the their kind of brief, like wind-like existence, sort of a nod to, you know, life is just maddeningly brief, even as it is the longest thing we know. But also that something that seems, I think a lot of us walk around feeling pretty inconsequential in this ever globalizing world, and yet the clouds, which are made of almost nothing, are what we find so beautiful about sunsets, or are what we look out for when we're on the ocean, trying to avoid storms or whatever. So it's both this acknowledgement that, yes, life is very short, and then also, you know, people who may seem, you know, there's just, I'm just one out of 7 billion and counting, and how significant and how much of an impact we actually can have, just like the cloud. But all from that one very weird, almost optical illusion of a person being kind of swallowed by a cloud.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm drawn to this because this particular poem and this image, because I'm from Southeast Michigan, south of Detroit, where it's very flat. And growing up there, you know, obviously it's cloudy a lot, except the clouds didn't have definition, I almost feel like. And I didn't realize it until I moved out to Pennsylvania, where I'm at now. Yeah. And I feel like I look up and the clouds have so much more definition than I've ever even comprehended. So it's completely, being here has completely changed the way that I think about what it is to be, you know, to look at clouds. It's interesting. And I find that very interesting.
Yeah. Almost like it's hard to tell where the clouds end and the sky begins versus, I remember when I first got glasses, I was probably like 6 years old, 6 or 7, and I put them on and the first thing I noticed was that the clouds have bumps. They're not just these like smudges in the sky. And I remember being just totally incapacitated by that for like 3 or 4 hours. And, that happens more in Colorado. Seattle, because there's clouds all the time, you just sort of forget that there's actually sky. And so that I never thought about it that way. But that whole like lack of definition and sort of it kind of blends in both with the sky and then also maybe the horizon. And it's sort of hard to tell because there's water everywhere, where the reflection is and where the water begins. Everything kind of gets really sort of fuzzy. Whereas in Colorado, everything is very sharp. We don't get a lot of clouds, and the ones we do are big and angry and have lots of storms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have had other poetry published other places and things like that. Are you working on any larger projects that that people might want to know about or might ought to know about?
Oh, gosh. Yes. I'm about 107... Microsoft Word pages into a fiction novel where the narrator, the main character, is homeless. I volunteer with Real Change, which is the street paper in Seattle, sold by low-income and homeless folks. And I've gotten to know these people and their stories, and I feel like it's sort of an underrepresented voice in literature. So. I've not actually attempted to write something this long, fiction-wise, before. But that is something that I am working surprisingly quickly on. I've got the scraps of a chapbook that is currently under construction. And then I have a rough and sort of uncomfortable draft of a Spanish chapbook. I have a completed English chapbook, 2 kind of full-length but don't feel like they're finished collections of poetry, and then a short story collection that I just finished about a month ago that I'm not totally sure is completely done, but has all the stories that I want in there. And then I periodically write nonfiction essays and things like that, short, sometimes very, very short, that just sort of come when I either encounter something that I need to process, so I end up writing about it, or that somebody asks me to write. So I feel like I'm pretty much always writing, and I can't really make up my mind about what I want to do. So there's all of those things are happening, kind of taking turns in the Rolodex there.
Sure. And that kind of leads me to my next and potentially final real question. Your blog, which is mentioned there, you publish stuff regularly, and with regards to that, or particularly your poetry, how do you deal with writer's block? How do you overcome with it? Do you ever experience it, or what do you, what's your remedy for people that might have writer's block?
Oh, yes. So I, sometimes I actually feel like writing is the block. It used to be that my urge to write was getting in the way of almost everything else. I would take a notebook everywhere, to like friends' houses for sleepovers and things like that when I was a kid. But I do experience blogger's block, which I guess would be the fear of writing in public. And so one of the ways that I handle that, it's sort of absurd, but I adapted an exercise that my AP English teacher taught me in high school, which is sort of like a free association thing that you do with when you're going to write an essay about a book. You pick all of the themes or words that are related to that book and then sort of free associate to kind of get ideas for essays. Well, when I have a particularly hard time, when I want to write, I'm sitting down to write and then nothing's happening, I'll pick a particularly ridiculous sounding word, like, you know, watermelon or fenestrate or arenaceous, which sounds like it should mean really good at being Aaron, but actually means of or relating to the hedgehog family. and I'll just write that word until something happens. And a lot of times what happens is I'll start to hear the word differently. I'll hear parts of the word that were not in the word that or that I hadn't come out. Like one time I was writing the word protest over and over again. This was about the time the Ferguson riots were happening. And I started writing protest over and over, and I got that the word wrote was in the word protest. And that turned into this big essay about protesting and what its purpose is, that started a discussion actually at the seminary that I attended. So that doesn't always happen, and sometimes I just have four sheets of the word watermelon. But that actually can also start a conversation if I happen to like leave it on my desk and my husband comes home and wants to know why I have watermelon on the grocery list 18 times and nothing else. And then I'll just sort of write a dialogue about that. So something goofy kind of happens with that. Or you could pick your favorite word, I guess. But that's not, I don't know if that would work for other people, but that seems to have at least springboarded something. Or it just makes me laugh, and then I don't feel so uptight about, you know, failing to be a writer that day or something. So either way, it ends up being beneficial and kind of funny for everybody who ends up getting involved there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's about everything I have for you. I want to thank you for, you know, such a great poem and for sitting down and giving up some of your time to talk to me and the people that do listen to this. So,
okay, wonderful.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I hope you have a good evening.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to the interview. I hope that you find this poem and all the others to be as enjoyable as we do. Be sure to check out the previously posted section, the Poetry Express section, and if you haven't subscribed, subscribe so you can get the best postcards delivered to your mailbox every month. Thanks.